Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
I'm not sure if you've noticed, but it's definitely allergy season. I love spring, but I struggle with allergies, which are not the most fun. Luckily, with Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, I can say bring on the blooms and face allergies head on. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved, so you can attack watery eyes and battle runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. I'm obsessed with Kleenex. I always have a box of tissues nearby. I'm always carrying them in my purse. I feel like that prepared friend. But I do have allergies. You could probably hear it in my voice this time of year. You know, we're struggling out here, okay? But if I'm going to be rubbing this tissue on my face, you know, I have makeup on. I want it to be like soft and comfortable. I don't want to be ripping up my nose. And that is why I love the Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, because they'd get the job done. They're non-irritating. They are just the go-to. I mean, doesn't everybody love Kleenex? I feel like I grew up using Kleenex. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
One-on-one with the excellent comedian Jim Jefferies is coming, and also just a good dude and funny, too. So we'll get into that in 1 second. First, I'll tell you about Bet Online. NBA, NHL playoffs. Bet Online has you covered. Get in on all the action, includes the new NBA playoff bracket contest. MLB continues through the summer as well. There's no shortage of ways to get in on the action. Bet Online has hundreds of odds, futures, and prop bets to bet on as well. Plus, their casino, well, it never closes. So head to the website today. Sign up to receive your welcome bonus on your first deposit. It's easy. Just visit betonline.ag, our exclusive partner at Podcast One. And don't forget, use the promo code Podcast One for your sign-up bonus today. You want to get in on boxing, UFC, soccer? It's all there at betonline.ag. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Jim Jefferies' Birthday Cocktail Party for February 14th. Let's see who's here. Yeah, it's one of the richest men in the world, Mike Bloomberg. Simon Pegg is here. NFL defensive end Jadeveon Clowney. Matchbox 20's Rob Thomas is here to push you around. And he will. And he will. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass. From Penn and Teller, Teller. Drew Bledsoe's here. And the lovely lady, Florence Henderson. Let's get back to the Adam Carolla Show.
It's a pretty good cocktail party for Jim Jefferies' birthday. Jim Jefferies is zooming in. Intolerant is the name of his latest stand-up. It's been out for a couple months now. It's available on Netflix. And fourth Netflix special, always funny. This is a longer form funny and less sort of joke rat-a-tat-tat, but super pleasing, and did it at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, which I've played a few times. Good to speak to you again, Jim.
Good to see you, mate. It's been a while. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah. So how are you handling all this stuff? And, you know, I talked to a lot of comedians, and some comedians are getting out there and performing. Other comedians are not doing anything at all. Some have, obviously, many big comedians like yourself have canceled tours. But what is the protocol for you in comedy?
Well, I canceled a tour and all that type of stuff. And then, you know, I'm mostly just doing my new podcast and all that. But I tried doing a show at the Magic Castle, and I hadn't performed since February. And I was working in new jokes at that stage, like back in February, because I just recorded my special. And I couldn't remember all my new jokes. And it's very hard to get a flow. And there's people in cars, and everyone was trying to do it as good as they could. They were having little clappers out the window and all that type of stuff and honking their horns and all that. But at the end of the day, I think I'm just going to sit it out now. and just wait and see how comedy is. Because all my new material that I was doing, I was doing 20 minutes on the Australian bushfires was the last show that I did.
Right.
And that feels like a long time ago now.
Yeah, I actually remember seeing you at the Laugh Factory several months ago, and we were talking about some of that and talking about it was funny. It's in the bit, but unfortunately, when the Australian bushfires come around, there's basically you and Olivia Newton-John, and that and Jocko or whoever the football player was. Was that Jocko? Am I making that guy up, or am I predating you and Jocko?
Jacko.
Yes. Yeah. So it's basically Jim Jefferies. And then you have to like raise all the money and host all the shows. And obviously you're obliged to do it because it's your native land.
I did so many charity gigs for the Australian bushfires. And then after doing 8 or 9 of them, I remember just going, look, I think they've raised all the money. I think the money's been raised.
Right.
Either the fires are out or they're not. They put all the trucks in front of it. If I go, here's another $100,000, that's not going to put out another fucking fire. So at the end, I was just going, I think they'll go out. And now that feels like a distant memory, not to the koalas, of course. We lost like half of them. But, I mean, it feels like now with COVID and just staying at home and all type of stuff, that the Australian bushfires.
Distant memory. I'll tell you, one of the things that's kind of screwing me up with this whole COVID thing is it is screwing up my sense of time. I'm trying, like I was thinking the other day, wait a minute, when are the Oscars and did we already have the Oscars? And I wrote for the Oscars like the last 2 years or the 2 years before that. So it's like, I know when the Oscars are and I couldn't wrap my mind around.
It's like February the Oscars come out or something?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is.
We already had those.
I guess. Does it feel like we even had them or like who won?
I wrote a couple of jokes for people in these Oscars. I remember Brad Pitt won everything and then there was another movie that people won. What was the movie? I don't know. But right. Yeah, we've had the Oscars. It was. Yeah. Just, but now they're just putting in days when they're just like, Jackie Robinson Day is meant to be in April, and then they went, oh, we missed that, so they just had it the other day.
Oh, you know really? What I mean?
Like they just throw things in at you. What are we going to do for Halloween? You've got kids,
yes,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Halloween, what's your plan? Because I can't take him around trick-or-treating, and I don't want to do something lame where I do some haunted thing in my backyard. I don't know whether I just call it a day or we all just get dressed up and watch a few movies.
Well, you have to understand that Halloween isn't what it used to be because my kids are so rich and fat that they don't do it. Like for us, there was a practical application to Halloween. Like I grew up going, I could eat a Reese's peanut butter cup for free on this day. That was kind of a big incentive to get dressed up like a pirate and leave the house. Now it's sort of a ritual and they enjoy it. But there's not a sense, there's not a practical sense to it. Like there was
We still have my kid's candy from last year in the cupboard. He doesn't realize that it's not been eaten.
That's,
he doesn't care.
That's what I'm saying. Like think about the practical, when you were a kid, when I was a kid, your birthday was important because you needed to get shit. You know, Christmas was important because you needed stuff. Like you wanted a skateboard or you wanted a walkie-talkie or a slot car set. Like it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Our kids kind of live in a world that if they want a slot car set, then just go talk to the nanny and she'll order it for you on Amazon and you'll have it in 2 days. And thus, Christmas, birthdays, things like that, these kinds of holidays are way less important.
My son has he brought a swear jar policy into the house and his mother set the prices. His mother doesn't even live with me. And she set the prices. Oh, you're paying $1.50 for the F-bomb, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm fucking dishing out about $10 a day. He's on me the whole time. Mm. It's like sometimes when I'm having a few friends over and I know I'm really going to swear it up, I just throw 40 in there and prepay so I can enjoy myself without fear.
Yeah, I was trying to kind of picture a pay scale for the swear jar. So I would have, you know, at the top of the list got to be the N-word, right? I mean,
yeah, the N-word, you get a college fund if you drop that in there. But no, like, what we're looking at is, in my house, it's saying cunt is, I think, $2, $1.50 for fucks, $1 for shits, and then, like, there's a whole lot of, like, damns and all that are, like, 25 cents, and I don't even consider them swear words. But also, my son's not that good at math, so I just lie to him and tell him that I've put that certain amount in. Every now and again, I just throw $5 in the jar and say, oh, that's how much I swore this week.
How old is your son now?
Seven.
And
seven. I'm actually in his bedroom
I
right
can
now
see that.
Because the people are having brunch downstairs. I don't, my room doesn't include a bunk bed and some spaceships.
Yeah. What is your arrangement with your baby mama, girlfriend / wife, son? Like, how does that? I've talked to Dr. Drew about it. Said it's a unique but effective relationship or business deal.
What we do is I have my girlfriend who lives here, and then I have my ex who lives down the road, and I get my son every second week, and she gets my son every second week, and then we all holiday together. NBC thought it was so interesting that we got along that they commissioned a pilot sitcom episode out of it. But I don't think it's weird at all, but people find it very odd that I get so along so well with my ex. I think part of it was that we had our child. She got pregnant after 2 months. So we never got a chance to be madly in love. And because we never got madly in love, we never got to madly hate each other either. Mm-hmm. We were always just mates who had a kid, you know?
Yeah. You didn't get that much sewage under the bridge. Like, you just didn't.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't date long enough to have resentment.
Right. Yeah, I get that. So maybe this is ideal for you.
Yeah. This is the best system. I've got a child with someone you just like, you know, because you'll always like them. Love turns to hate. Like never really moves anywhere.
So I want to talk about your journey. And by the way, the podcast that Jim spoke of, I don't know about that, with Jim Jefferies, is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well. I know in a recent episode you had Jay Leno to talk cars. So here's a thought for you. I was saying this the other day to somebody. I think you can tell me if you agree with this.
Okay.
I think you can tell a lot about a culture from the cars that they appreciate or that they gravitate toward, or the type of cars. So
I would agree. I would agree. Like, Australia is, I think, the only nation on earth apart from North America, only continent apart from North America, that is into muscle cars.
Right.
I don't know anywhere else. There's other people that have cars with turbos and stuff like that. But, like, you know, the Japanese can make, like, a fast car and all type of stuff. But like an actual muscle car, one that goes, but like, real big noise. That's the thing that Australia and America has in common, which I can't think of another place that does this. The British definitely don't do it.
Right. So let's talk about that, because I did have a little revelation. I was saying to somebody, the culture is embodied in the car. And
right.
When you take a look at German cars, it's all efficiency. It's not a lot of flash. You know, it's not Ferrari and it's not big hot rods. It's all about sleek, fast. I mean, when you look at German race cars from the 70s, the engines look like nothing. There's lots of plastic on them and stuff like that. It wasn't meant to be admired visually.
Everything's efficient and engineering and getting the job done. Which you can say what you want about the Germans, but
right.
That's what they've done in history.
they were taskmasters. So
yeah. You
have that in German. And then you go, okay, what about Japanese? And Japanese is, like, smaller and even more efficient. How can we get the most horsepower out of this 1.6 liter motor? So and very kind of austere, like, not flashy, but just kind of get it done with precision, but also we're thinking about with an eye on the price. It can't be too expensive, you know? And then you think about the Mexican car culture and you think low and slow, like low rider, chillax, take it, you know, it's the opposite of Germany, right? It is like slow it down, have a Corona, enjoy the day, take it low, take it slow. And of course, America is like in your face, cubic inches, big horsepower. And I was like, okay, that aligns with all the temperaments of the cultures we're talking about. And the British are kind of a combination. They're kind of efficient, but a lot more style and a lot less functionality. You know, they want to look good.
They like sleek, or they like, you know, or like the Morris might. It has to be kitschy.
Right.
The British like a kitschy looking car.
Right. And you
remember, like they had that three-wheeled car they used to have.
Yeah. You would go, well, the wiring's no good, or it doesn't start on cold days. And I go, yeah, but look at it. It's kitschy. It's cool, you know. Yeah. But then I said, Australia V8. People here don't know how big a deal the V8 is. And they had the big V8 racing series, and it's in Australia, and Mad Max and all that stuff. So speak a little to that, because I don't think people know that.
We have a race called Bathurst in Australia, which is just done on regular roads. And it has to be cars that you can buy. And it's always Ford versus Holden. And when you're a kid, it was like whether your dad drove a Ford or your dad drove a Holden, that was the argument you got into in the schoolyard, whether you're a Holden person or a Ford person. Now they don't really make cars in Australia anymore. But, yeah, the V8s, like Mad Max, it always amazed me they had Mad Max. So all the petrol's gone. There's no more gas in society. We've run out. And what have you decided to keep? The V8s. You're getting something that's got about 7 miles to the gallon, and you went, they're the ones we'll keep when all the gasoline runs out. No smart cars, no small hatchbacks, no Priuses. They go, oh, we'll keep a Holden Monaro with a turbo in it.
Yeah, supercharger, by the way. But either way, it wasn't naturally aspirated, as Jay Leno would say. And I'm trying to think of, is Holden a subsidiary of like GM? Was it kind of GM versus Ford? Now Chris has to look what Holden, who the sort of parent company of Holden,
I think they stopped making cars in Australia, but Holden was, I think they're the same company as Opel and Vauxhall.
Oh, okay. So they're like European company.
They're formerly known as General Motors Holden.
They were formerly known as General Motors Holden. I knew there had to be some GM versus Ford competition going over there. But as I was trying to think of the Australian temperament in my automotive versus culture thought, I thought the V8 works well for the Australians. Like they're big, they're in your face, they're loud, they're V8 culture. So Jim, what for you? I mean, do you think about what you would like to do, what you'd like to do next, things you haven't done, things you'd like to do?
I was getting ready to do like a multicam sitcom, and that was, we were 6 days out from production before everything shut down. And I know that they get a lot of shit from people, and people think that, you know, because of the laughter and all that type of stuff. But I've always wanted to do one because I think acting as a comedian, it's very hard when you're acting in a sitcom that's like a single cam and you're not getting laughs. And a comedian, well, me personally, I need to get laughs or I don't know whether I'm being funny or not. I can't really tell, you know. And so I was looking forward to having a studio audience for that. And apart from that, I'm also working on a children's book. That's what happens when you've been locked in your house for 6 months, you know, because I've been reading with my son so much and I'm like, I think I could write one of these fucking things. But that's what all celebrity parents do, is it? Every time you get like a celebrity parent and all of a sudden they think that they've made a line of baby carriers or something like that, like they're the first person ever to have a child.
Right.
So I'm doing a bit of that business. But, yeah, the sitcom, I think stand-up-wise, I've probably got one more special in me and I don't think I need to record any more specials. I just think that'll be number nine for me. And I just think that, like, if the Beatles were still making albums, would people buy them? Like, Elton John brings out an album every year. No one gives a fuck. We have the first 10 that we all enjoyed, and then that's it. So I just, like, I feel like there's diminishing returns on the more specials I bring out. So maybe one more.
Well, you know, it's got the word special in it. So once you get to 63 specials, how special are the specials, if you kind of think about it?
Yeah, I should start calling them regulars. Because right. I've been doing one every 2 years for the last 16 years. It's like, you know, bring out another regular.
Well, this is an interesting thing to discuss, and I'll circle back to talk about children's books. Children's books are a lot like modern art. When you go into a museum and you see a Rembrandt, you go, I could never do that. That's like a 400-page novel. When you see modern art, you go, fuck, if I got high enough, I could do that. And when you read when you read children's books, all you think of is there are 9 words on each page, and the person who wrote the words didn't do the illustrations, so I could definitely shit out one of these in 20 minutes. So
exactly. You just got to pick an animal that's got some problem, and then how's he going to resolve it at the end of the day?
And there needs to be alliteration. So if it's a hippo, it's got to be Henry. That's how it works. You find an animal, give a name, has to start with the first letter of the title of the animal, and then he goes in a journey, gets in a little trouble, and then resolves it at the end.
Exactly. And everyone, and they learn a small lesson that is something to do with eating your vegetables or, you know, everyone gets scared on their first day of school.
Right. Right. You could break the mold by having the animal actually be killed by a poacher at the end.
Yeah, and they did everything right, and the world still screwed them over, and they never learned a lesson. That's the real lesson right there. And it turned out the bully still beat the shit out of them, even though they stood up to them. The end.
So I know this. It is kind of dangerous going, if you just stand up to the bully's going to back down. I don't know. That may work in some instances, but when it doesn't work, I'm not sure how that works.
Yeah. Yeah. The truth always comes out, except for the times when people get away with things.
So you're talking about stand-up specials, and you've done 9, and it is...
I've done eight.
You're going to do nine. Sorry. You do one more. And I've never heard another comedian sort of talk about, maybe I've said what I needed to say... Yeah. Or at least captured it. When I did the Man Show, we did 100 episodes. And when we were done with 100 episodes, Jimmy and I kind of looked at each other and went, well, we've said what we wanted to say. Like, right. we did 100 episodes. Let's face it. All your good ideas are used up in the first 7 episodes. The next 93, you're just getting paid and trying to come up with funny shit. But all the stuff you wanted to say was in the first season, you know. And then we're like philosophical about it. Like, yeah, why just have it coast to a stop? Why not? You got 100 examples. And I think you could say having 9 stand-up specials, that's a lot. That's a lot of material.
Yeah, yeah. I, as I said, I always find it weird that Paul McCartney in his concerts, he's like, I just bought a new song this year. And you're like, okay.
Right.
All right. Well, we'll hear it.
Yeah.
I like what Billy Joel did. Billy Joel, I think it was the River of Dreams. And then they stopped playing him on radio. And then he went, oh, you can all get fucked. And now he still just sells out the arenas all the time. He hasn't put out a new album since I think about 98 or something.
Well, it is a little sad in that you hear, like we were talking about the other day on the podcast, we were talking about the band, the Presidents of the United States of America. And they had that song Lump, which was a big hit, and they had Peaches.
They did the Millions of Peaches song.
Right. They did all that. Yeah. And that was in 1995 or 96 or whenever it was. And then you go, what happened to those guys? And then you go look it up, and they broke up 2 years ago. And you're like, what were they doing between 95 and 2 years ago? And the answer is trying to sell more albums. And in a way, maybe what you're talking about is the better way to go strategically.
Yeah, I think I can tell you what the Presidents were up to, because about 10 years ago when I started doing little theaters in America, 10 years ago, for whatever reason, my routing system was wherever I was, it must have been the same touring company, the Presidents were on the night before me. Mm. So I know what they were up to 10 years ago. They were playing 500-seat rooms. That's what they were up to 10 years ago. And I assume it didn't get better from there. There may have been even more of a dip.
Yeah, and I'm not knocking them because they're nice.
No, no,
they're
no,
nice
they have
guys.
Big albums. There's yeah, just they have big albums.
There's just a kind of a cycle to things,
yeah.
And it's difficult as a comedian or as a performer that sort of cycle. You know, to go from selling millions of copies of a record to thousands of copies of a record.
And it doesn't matter. It's not like they're not talented anymore or they're not writing good songs. It's just that people are choosing not to even give them a listen anymore.
Yeah. So let's talk about this sitcom, because I'm with you in that I think sometimes people poo-poo a genre. Like they go, yeah, multi-camera sitcom. Oh, give me a break. There's a way to do it that is, in a weird way, tell me if you agree with this, or tell me what you think of this. I've been in a few venues or mediums where there was no cussing. You know, when I did, you know, when you do stand-up, cuss your ass off. When you do radio, morning radio, no cussing. When you're on Dancing with the Stars, nothing even close to cussing, right?
Yeah, and no innuendo.
Right, and people would say, well, isn't it going to be difficult to be funny when you're in a situation where you cannot express yourself? There's a bunch of rules. And I would say, no, it presents an even greater challenge. But it's not – that's now the challenge. How can you be funny with all these sort of restrictions, so to speak? And I look at a multi-camera sitcom as sort of the same way. Like, how can you be – how can you do an incredible sitcom with a kind of old – genre? Or
the people shit on them and say they're terrible, but it's Seinfeld and Cheers are two of the greatest TV shows ever. Frasier was an amazing show. You know, the Jeffersons, Archie Bunker,
all the family
shows were good. And it's like you bring them up and then people are like, oh, they're exceptions to the rule. And it's like, well, yeah, but there's a load of shit multicam sitcoms, but there's also a load of shit songs and there's a load of shit stand up and there's a load of shit whatever. So it's trying to crack that code on what makes a good multicam sitcom. You know, the amount of people who hate multicam sitcoms and then sit down and watch Friends on repeat over and over and over again, which for some reason with a single cam, you never do that as much. You never watch a single, maybe The Office is watchable where you watch it over and over, but for the most part, those multicam sitcoms, that you can watch them all the time. Now the easy thing about doing the show, and that people may not know, is that it's a really good working week. Like, you write the script, you rehearse it. It's 9 to 5. It's not like you're doing night shoots and locations and driving all around town and stuff. It's all done in one stage, and you have a little office and a dressing room and your catering's there. And so it's a really nice environment to work in as well. So, you know, there's a lot of pluses to it. I think that's why a lot of actors, especially people with families, are like, oh, I'll do a multicam sitcom because I get to go home and see my kids every now and then.
Oh, the multicam sitcom schedule. Now, see, yours is going to be a little different because you're going to be very involved with the writing.
Yeah.
But if you're just starring in a multi-sitcom, multi-camera sitcom, you show up like Monday for a table read at noon and leave at 1 o'clock, and then show up on Wednesday for a walkthrough and then tape on Friday. I mean, it is, you know, I don't think that people really realize that at a certain point, show business becomes a job. It has a schedule. It has early mornings. It has late nights. And there are things that are unattractive about that schedule. Like, it is difficult to do the early morning into the night, you know, burn the midnight oil and all that kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, you give an actor a big time payday and give them that kind of freedom and that kind of schedule, it's attractive.
Well, I always thought, like, I've met a couple of movie stars in my day, and you always think like, oh, that must be the life, being a movie star, having women adore you and being able to go on the red carpet. I tell you what, an A-list movie star, I don't know if there's anyone who works harder. If for you to bring out 2 blockbuster movies a year, that's 8 months of you living outside of your home in different locations and traveling to the snow and traveling to the beach and all this type of stuff, and then doing 12-hour days. And then after the film is done, you have to do the press junket in each different city so you can promote the fucking thing. Nah, man. I think being a real A-list actor is a tough gig. I'd rather be an E-list celebrity like myself and do a multicam, I think. That's what I'm more suited for.
I was curious to get your take on this. What's going on in the world and in this country especially? We're talking about the Australian bushfires at the beginning of this interview. I was watching the news. And I was watching all the stuff in Portland where they're like firing bottle rockets at the cops and all the fireworks, all the crazy fireworks that everyone's just lighting off and firing at the mayor's condo and firing at the cops and firing up into the air. And then the next thing is they've dragged a mattress out in the middle of the street. They're burning the mattress and they're burning everything and they're firing off fireworks everywhere. And I thought to myself, this country must have a moratorium. This country, if you're a smoker, you should be able to smoke wherever the fuck you want for the next 10 years. You should be able to walk out into the middle of downtown and light a cigarette or go to the beach or go anywhere and smoke for 10 years because we have had more fires in the streets, more fireworks lit off. Like, that's... I think if anything good comes of this, smokers should just get a 10-year window of you will not get a summons, you will not get a ticket, you can smoke at the park, you can smoke in a hospital, you can smoke at the mayor's house, you smoke wherever you want because of what we put up into the air over the last 6 months.
Well, but that's also the thing about the old smoking. It's like back, you know, what 30 years ago when we smoked on airplanes and stuff like that, it's pretty gross smoking on an airplane because you're in an enclosed tube. But I'll tell you this much, not one of them caught on fire. You never looked on a plane going past and it was in flames and you went, oh, there must have been a smoker on that one.
Yeah, when I grew up, every third news story was a fire in a trailer home because a guy fell asleep smoking. By the way, they never really accurately couched it. It wasn't fell asleep smoking. It was passed out smoking. You don't.
Yeah. You're always drunk and you're passed out with a cigarette in your hand. You're like,
yeah, no, nobody had an eye shade on and a glass of warm milk on their nightstand. The fucking TV was on, the volume was up, and they were on a sofa, and there's a bottle of, you know, Old Crow on the coffee table.
And the fire lit up when they spilt vodka on their chest instead of flying, you know, as they were going to bed.
Your dad, I'm a woodworker. I was a woodworker. That was my job. I was a cabinet maker.
My father was a cabinet maker, yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. Like, I worked at a Euro cabinet shop. I worked in a sort of traditional American-style cabinet shop as well. Was that... So, multiple questions. One is, like, in Germany, if you're a cabinet maker, then it means you went through an apprenticeship, and now you're a journeyman, and blah, blah, blah. What's Australia? And here, it's catch-as-catch-can. You either can make cabinets or you can't. There's no certificate or license or anything like that.
Well, my father had to go through an apprenticeship. He left school at, I 15 or something like that, and became an apprentice cabinet maker. And then after he became a cabinet maker, he moved to England for a bit. And the English are notoriously, and if they're listening now, they'll get pissy with me for saying this, but they're always trying to get out of work. You know, like if I never took a TV meeting in Britain that wasn't in the pub, and then when I came to America, it was all like a round table and conference screens and everyone taking it seriously. All the deals I made in Britain were in the pub. You know, and then we drank at lunch on Friday and then it just continued. And so my father went over, like, being a cabinet maker in Australia, and he started working for different companies and stuff like that. And he was told by all of them to slow down. You're making us all look bad. You know,
really?
So because he had a pretty good work ethic, I think he made a bit of coin out there, did quite well, came back to Australia, and he just became a sole trader. Just making cabinets himself just around the place. I think I might call my next special Son of a Carpenter. I've always wanted to call one of them that, but I've never found the right opportunity.
Yeah, it's good. So your dad, did he work? Did he have a shop when you were a young person? Did he work from his garage? How did he do it?
No, he just worked. He worked from the garage. He had a Holden EK 1962 Holden, which wasn't a very practical vehicle for a cabinet maker. He just had some roof racks on the top. He'd build the cabinets. He'd put them up on top of the car, and off he'd drive. And he was quite well known around the area, so he made different cabinets for tons of people. It's funny because my dad, he came out to live with me because my mother passed away, so he came out to live with me. And then we got him out of here just before the corona kicked off, you know, like a week before quarantine. I said, oh, you better get out of here. And I moved him out. He would have been a bloody nightmare to have here during the whole thing, you know, trying to take care of an old person and make sure they don't get it and all that type of stuff. So I was really glad that I got him out of the country in time. Because Australia, COVID at the moment, they had it down to zero. They had it down to, about 50 cases or something. And then there's all these different hotel rooms. And then there was this one. So when you land in Australia, you have to go to a hotel and quarantine for 2 hours. They pick you up in a bus. You don't even know what hotel you're going to. You could be a Motel 5. It could be a Four Seasons, whatever. So they get driven on this bus to this hotel. They got the COVID down to almost zero. And then a couple of the security guys started shagging a few of the girls that would come over on holiday, and they were stuck in the room. They gave them the COVID. They took the COVID back to their estate, and now Australia's fucked again and shut its borders down because of two blokes who just wanted to get their end away.
Yeah, but if one of those blokes was at a party of mine, I would still treat him as a hero.
Oh, no, that's the whole thing. The Australian public isn't even angry. They're like, yeah, we get what happened there. Yeah, we understand.
Did you say
you've got to play your angles?
Did you say they're quarantined for 2 hours or two?
2 weeks.
Two weeks. Okay, just wanted to be clear. Your dad, so it's weird, like they talk about AIDS coming to America with that gay flight attendant. Maybe COVID was reawoken in Australia by two of the straightest dudes on the planet.
Yeah, quite possible. Wasn't that guy either gay? He was a Canadian, he was like a flight attendant from Toronto or something. He was patient zero, I believe.
Yeah, that's as they, you know, that's what they say. I mean, who the hell knows? So your dad, he has a good sort of work ethic, right? And he's a,
right.
If you're a cabinet maker, you're practically minded. Like you're not up in, you're not pie in the sky. You're not talking about, it's not a lot of pablum. It's a lot of, it's a lot of straight talk, right?
Right.
Is that basically who your dad was?
Yeah. He was a straight talk. Well, see, in saying that, my mother, before she passed away, she was very, she used to tell my father to shut up all the time, right? Every time my dad went to talk, my mother would go, shut up, Gary, you're an idiot. And she would say that in public. And I always used to stick up for him and go, hey, leave him alone. Maybe he's got something good to say. Anyway, my mother was dead for about 2 days before we figured out what an important part she was in the ecosystem of the family. Like now we're dealing with Gary Unleashed. And he's a lot of opinions, my dad. A lot of opinions.
Yeah. No, it's kind of funny. Like, if you become a big celebrity, you need a couple of the old neighborhood guys around to tell you that those ostrich cowboy boots make you look like an asshole. But you can't have a bunch of yes men that are on the payroll going, those boots are awesome, boss, because then you don't have that filter, you know? So your mom...
I think that's probably close to the point. Yeah.
Your mom played a very integral part in your father's conversational skills. I like that. I like the ecosystem notion of it, because once in a while you go, I don't like bats. And they go, yeah, but the bats eat the mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes are what spread malaria. And so it's like your mom was like a bat in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. My mom was keeping the rodent population down in the house.
That's right. So your dad was this talkative guy who was kind of a straightforward guy. Where does, for you, the comedy, did your parents possess that?
My mother's a humorless person. My father's very funny. My father's very funny, and but my mother didn't really have a sense of humor. But like everybody thought she did. You know, everyone thinks they have one. Mm-hmm. And whenever someone who has no sense of humor, they go, oh, I have a very dry sense of humor. I have a very unique sense of humor. It's like, no, you just don't know what funny is, you know.
Right.
And so my mother never really laughed at anything. And then I got two brothers, and one of them's funny and the other one's not, you know. It's like, I look at it like a gene that goes through you, like if you're athletic or whatever, you know. So, like, my son's got it. One of my nieces have it, but another one of my nieces doesn't. My nephew doesn't have it, you know. So it's like, do you see it in your kids? Do you see which one's funny or whatever? I know you can't say on the show.
The boy. Yes. No, I've talked to people about this a lot because I think they think that it's born from some pain or it's how you process your childhood or something like that. And it's like, no, some kids are musical. Right. I always bring up the example that always stuck with me is I interviewed Tommy Lee once and I said, how did you start drumming? And he said, when I was five, I just banged on pots and pans for long enough till my parents bought me a drum kit, you know, like that. He's a drummer. That's what he did. And I feel the same way about humor. I was always trying to make jokes and making parody songs in my head and, you know, having these little listening to commercials and making fun of them, you know, on TV and that kind of stuff. And watching Saturday Night Live and coming into school the next day trying to memorize, you know, the Conehead bit or something like that. And that's,
I used to do podcasts, but before podcasts, I used to just get a cassette and put it in a player and then record like an hour of me talking and saying funny things. And to no one would ever hear it.
Right.
It would never exist in any platform. And then I'd listen to it back and go, that was pretty good. And I remember thinking to myself, if people did hear this, they'd enjoy this.
Well, why did you think that? Because your mom wasn't fostering that. I do want to say this. I don't think your parents and your environment give you a sense of humor, but they can foster it in the sense that my parents, whenever I told a joke or did anything, went, I don't care. Be quiet. No one's listening. Don't write that down. You know, and they can talk you out of your sense of humor. I was talked out of my sense of humor for a lot of years. It eventually rose up, but I was talked out of it. I was broken out of my sort of will to tell jokes for a long time.
Who is the person in your life that fostered? Because there's always going to be someone. I remember there was a school teacher who kept on telling me I was really funny, and that sort of encouraged me. There's always one teacher who said that I should do comedy. You know, I did a couple of open mic spots when I was 17 because of this teacher who constantly encouraged me to do it. But my family, I think they thought my brother was funnier than me, and maybe he was, you know what I mean? So I don't know which one I was, you know. My other brother was the sporty one, and then my other brother was the funny one, and I was just, I don't know what I was.
Yeah, so was your dad encouraging it and your mom sort of stepping on it?
Dad didn't encourage it either way. I don't think he thought it was you know, you got to understand as well, that is one thing to be in America and go, oh, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian, and know that the Comedy Store's up the road and the Improv is over there. And it doesn't matter if you're in Cincinnati, there's the place called the Chuckle Hut or Coconuts or whatever. You know, there's every town, every little village has a comedy club, and you can go watch it and you can go, you know, see all the. And when I was growing up in Sydney, there was one comedy club, the Comedy Store in Sydney, and that was it in a city of almost 5 million people. And so to get an open mic to do an actual spot there, you had to wait months and months and months to get an actual spot. So and all the successful comedians that were Australian, they all, you know, the most you could hope for is to be a morning radio person. That's like if you really nailed it. There was no touring acts or anything like that. So it didn't even seem to me, when I wanted to do it, to be an occupation. It only seemed to be something that you could do as a hobby. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a famous stand-up Australian comedian at that stage. There wasn't one. You know, we had Paul Hogan, but he wasn't a stand-up. He was an actor.
Right.
And, you know, so then when I moved to England, and there's, you know, almost as many comedy clubs in the UK as there is in all of America, and they're all so close together and you can drive. And I was like, oh, this is an actual job people can do. And I never saw it like that before. I just saw it as a hobby that I really wanted to do. You know, see, the first time I did stand-up wasn't to do it as a career. It was to see if I could do it.
Right. Yeah, the challenge, the fear of it. And so what did you think you would do for a living?
I at that stage, I was working in bars and I was selling mobile phones in the infancy of the mobile phones. You know, I was selling those brick, great big brick mobile. I was selling mobile phones that used to cost like $3,000 a pop, you know, and people used to come in to get these things. And I'd go, this is a good one. This one's got a 9-hour battery. Like, right. Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. 9-hour battery, 35 minutes talk time. You know, right. Like that was a pretty good one. So, you know, so I'd do that. And I was selling like car stereos and shit like that. And then I figured I'd probably have to, you know, my brother was a cop. I remember thinking, and he was already quite high up in the police force. So I was thinking I could probably be a cop or something. You know what I mean? Like I was thinking of functional jobs. I went and studied musical theater at university and I thought about that, but then I got nodules in my vocal cords and I went, well, that's not going to happen. I really just wanted a job in entertainment, but I just didn't know how to get one. But I think I was a professional comic at the age of 22 or something. So that was quite a short time of me worrying about that.
Yeah, I always think about the haves and the have-nots, and I realize everyone always talks about where you're from or how much money your parents have, but it's really a mindset, which is when you grow up in your kind of environment, and certainly in my kind of environment, you don't have thoughts about pursuing dreams or doing what you love for a living. The thoughts are about having a job and getting paid to do your job. And the job could be selling phones. It could be a cop. It could be a construction worker. Yeah. It was just sort of jobs, you know, like, yeah, you got paid for your job. And then, so the business model was you go do something you don't really want to do for 8 or 9 hours a day. And then on Friday, at the end of the day, they give you money. And then you can go out and do shit you do want to do for a day and a half, and then you got to sober up and you have to come back Monday morning and do shit you don't want to do.
The whole plan was to get as fucked up as possible from Friday evening all the way through till Sunday afternoon.
Right.
And then you go, all right, and that's living for the weekend, yeah. And then when you become a comic, like a stand-up comic, those two worlds sort of splice together. Where because you start doing that when you've got the daytime job and it is your hobby, it is your entertainment and your social group and where you meet girls and where you get I remember thinking, what a wonderful job where they give you free beer, you know. And so comedy was always that, and then it becomes a job, and so then it's a little tricky not to be drinking every day or not to be getting to mesh like the party going on the whole time, and you have to start thinking of it as an actual business. And sometimes that can ruin it a little bit for you, because I think the most fun I ever had as a stand-up comedian was when I was full of optimism that it may happen. And then when it did happen, it's like, how do I stay here?
Yeah, well, let's talk about that may happen for a moment, because this is a important thing in life, which is there's a version of that with a woman. There's a version of that with a sports car. There's a version of that with a career where the real excitement is sort of right before the car is delivered, or right before you have sex with the woman, or right before you get that break, that sense of kind of anticipation. Maybe it's a sort of a foreplay of life, a sort of a wonderment, you know, planning. You know, I used to sit around with Jimmy Kimmel when he was 26, and we'd be eating at the Acapulco Inn Mexican restaurant because I had a coupon that was a 2-for-1 entree lunch special, and we'd be kind of scheming about, oh, we could do a show together one day. And then at some point we were doing the show. And then at some point we're in, you know, season 4 of the show. And then at some point we're just sort of showing up and looking at a big schedule going, oh, boy, that's a lot of work. And now we're in it. You know what I mean? And the important part of life is, how do you kind of keep that sense of appreciation / wonderment when you're 25 years in to your career, or marriage for that matter?
Yeah, I think the wonderment's the hard thing, but I think it's more having to keep because you're not going to be amazed by something for over and over and over again, like including like a wife. You're not going to see your wife every day and go, wow. But what you do have to do is keep the appreciation. Like, you have to appreciate that this beautiful woman wants to be with you, and she mothered your children and all that type of stuff. And you got to have a job that, you know, you got to, I always try to remember that my life is someone else's dream. You know what I mean? Somebody else dreams of my life. So whenever I get the shits with it, I have to remember that it's someone else's fantasy. And not everybody's, but there's someone out there who looks at my life and goes, that would be sweet.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of people. And then to a lesser extent, if you live in this country and you have a job at a Costco, there's many people around the world that are dreaming of driving your mid-sized car and living in your two-bedroom apartment and working at a place that's malaria-free since 1914. You know what I mean? Like, in a bigger global sense, just living here, having a roof over your head, having a air conditioning and a TV set, I mean, globally, that you are the envy of the world.
Yeah. Oh, well, most definitely. I don't doubt for a second that I'm very lucky in life. I've been very blessed. And when I say blessed, I'm not religious. I've been so blessed. But you know, 100%, yeah, just to be living in America, you're already a winner. And just to be having fresh water, you're already a winner and all that type of stuff. But then, you know, there's always people above you that you can strive to be. Like, do you think like Brad Pitt and George Clooney ever look at each other and go, oh, how did that guy get that movie? I wanted that one. You reckon they're ever disappointed?
I think it is sad. It's a sad but somewhat necessary component of especially people who live in this country where you say, you know, you have two cars and 5,000 square feet. Isn't that enough? You know, isn't that enough? Fill in the blank. You know, isn't that enough? When is that? And so then there becomes this balance between, well, how is it not enough so you're motivated to go out and get more? On the other hand, how do you simultaneously appreciate not enough? You know what I mean?
Like, there's the argument. Like, I watched that The Last Dance thing, and what I sort of learned was Jordan was an asshole. You know, he just needed to have competition, so he needed to have enemies for him to succeed, you know. And I don't know if that's a way to live, but he was really, really successful and really, really good at what he did. And maybe you have to be a bit of an asshole to be that winning a human being. And I don't know if I have it in me that I need to constantly win. I don't know. I'm like Andrew Biden. Like, I've won a couple of things, but you're not going to hear from me forever.
Well, you know, I guess the thing is how do you stay motivated without doing what Jordan did, which is feeling like everyone was trying to knock him off, you know what I mean, out to get him. And I would suggest you can do both, but I don't know if you can do it at Jordan's level.
No.
Maybe at Pippen's level you could do it, but at Jordan's level, I think those guys do feel, and rightfully so, not rightfully so, but in order to get from great to the best ever, I think you have to have that. Maybe Tom Cruise has that.
Yeah, I think Tom Cruise. I hear that Tom Cruise like goes around parties. This might be a wives' tale. And everybody who meets him thinks like they're the only person in the world. He comes up and he goes, oh, Adam, it's great to see you. How's your podcast going? Your children are good. What, are you still working on your car? And he seems to know little bits about you. And then everyone's like, oh, wow, the biggest movie star in the world knows all about me. But it turns out that his assistants already Googled everybody in the room. And just before he walks up to you, they say, oh, this is the deal with this person. And then people feel so special after that. They went, well, at least he went to the effort to do that, right? So that guy's being a movie star 24 hours a day. He knows how important is the image and how each individual thinks about him. Me, on the other hand, I fuck up with customer service and I'm rude to people or something like that occasionally. Normally I'm nice to people, but occasionally I wouldn't be a good A-list celebrity all the time. I'd be fucking in trouble. Like, you know, you're always in trouble, Adam.
Yeah, I am. No, I was thinking, it's funny. Sometimes you have to kind of observe yourself and sort of see yourself through the eyes of the other person. And you're right. I've met Tom Cruise at a party, and I swear there's an unmarked van out there with a guy in a microphone, and he had an earpiece in. That guy, he probably was wearing glasses with a camera in it, and they were scanning everyone and IMDBing everyone's name. And yes, he is that way. And that's so Tom Cruise is like an ambassador to his own country called, you know, Cruiselaria or something like that is his land. And he's the spokesperson for it and the ambassador to it. And he does it great. And I was thinking about this, which was I was doing a show in San Diego and I was filming a show, doing a stand up show in San Diego a number of months ago. And a couple of people I went to high school with showed up. And there were people I knew sort of peripherally from high school, but that we weren't great friends. We went to high school together. And as a matter of fact, they were a little higher up on the social pecking order than I was, you know? And that was fine. We got along. We never hung out. We didn't go do things together, what have you. But of course, as the years have gone by and as I became notable, then of course we became better friends invisibly sort of over the years, you know, which I get. It's what everyone does. It's happened a million times. It's happened to you. It happens to everyone. But at some point we're like kind of standing in my dressing room and they were talking to me like, this is great. Remember all the great old times we had and blah, blah, blah. And I was being cordial. But after a certain period of time, I had to do the second show and I was like, okay, well, there you go. Moving on. You know, that kind of thing. And they both sort of looked at me and went, well, that's it? Or why are you saying that? And I was like, we're done. You know what I mean? Yeah. We weren't great friends in high school. And now this is kind of nice. But now it's time to do the second show. And they both looked at me like, God, what an asshole. Like, this guy's turned into some sort of celebrity asshole. And I had to kind of examine that. Like, what must that be like, or how are they processing that? In my mind, it was a simple equation. We didn't hang out much in high school, and now we were hanging out a little in my dressing room, but it was time to move on.
Yeah. No, I've had the exact same thing happen. I had a couple of my bullies show up and show up and come backstage, and I'm like, fuck it. What am I going to do? I'm not going to. And then the same thing, they start reminiscing about all the great times you had. And I'm like, you went to had a different experience from me. But I always think that about bullying, though. I don't think I was ever a bully, but maybe. I don't think anybody thinks they're bullying. I think everyone thinks they're just defending themselves or trying to get by, you know?
Yeah, well, there's two interesting parts of that. One is I had a guy when I was kind of a civilian living in an apartment, drunk driver destroy my car in his pickup truck, like literally passed out at the wheel, hit my car, destroyed my car, didn't want to pay for my car, ran from the cops, ended up in court, blah, blah, blah. And 20 years later, I ran into that guy in a Home Depot in Burbank. And he was like, Adam Carolla, I destroyed your car. Like, it was some kind of reunion. And I was like, yeah, you did. You destroyed my car. And then we went and got in front of the judge and you didn't want to pay me for the car. And then you didn't make the payments. But he's acting like we're old chums from high school. The other thing about bullying, and this is interesting, I realize I don't think I've bullied anyone either, but as I really drill down on it, you could probably get together a sizable group of people who think I bullied them, and who's to say they're not right. Yeah. And I'll tell you the realization I had. When I was doing the Man Show a million years ago, we thought it'd be a funny bit to get hold of all the girls I dated who sort of dumped me when I was working construction and making 12 bucks an hour and driving a pickup truck and a loser. And we do this whole thing where we'd get them all together and go, don't you wish you'd stayed with him now? Now he's on a TV show and blah, blah, blah. So I told one of the producers, well, here's this gal, here's her name, you could run her down, and here's this other gal. She dumped me and she dumped me and then she dumped me, and then find her and say, like, aren't you sad you dumped him? And the producers got hold of all those women, and the story was, oh, no, we didn't dump him. He dumped us. I was like, oh, I guess it just feels like every time I broke up with someone, I got dumped. That's what it feels like to me. But It's mathematically impossible, right? I would have to dump somebody at some point, or maybe it just felt that way to them. Like, it's an interesting process. They meant it. They were like, no, he dumped us.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's the same way with bullying. Maybe you just feel like you've never bullied, but maybe you have.
Well, that's the whole thing with bullies. You fight back with them, and you tease them back because they bullied you, and then they feel like you're the one who's always teasing them, and it just goes around and around in a circle.
An interesting note to go out on. We'll have to continue this, Jim, because the hour just zipped by, and I feel like there's so much more to talk about.
Yeah, man, whatever you want. I'm on whatever you want.
Please, and if you'd ever like me to do your podcast, I'd be honored, of course.
What would your specialty subject be?
Could be carpentry.
Yeah, carpentry's good.
I know carpentry. Your dad would be happy to know. I know all about cabinet making. I could tell him the difference between a rabbit joint and a dado.
A dovetail joint or whatever it's called.
But that's a little highfalutin, but we'd go with like a dado or a rabbit joint or maybe even a... there's dovetail and there's finger joint as well.
My dad was a big dovetail guy.
Well, as I think we discussed maybe on the air, your dad was a very precision-oriented guy.
Yeah.
I was a little more in the knock it out, get paid kind of. I used to have a saying, which was, you can't see it from my house. That's what we would always say when you screwed something up at someone else's house.
Did you write that on the side of your bus, your truck?
We had two sayings on the construction site, which is if someone was spending too much time on something, they'd say two things. They'd go, "We're not building a fucking piano." That was the one thing. The next thing you'd say if you wanted to piss off someone who was under you, you'd say, "We've got a dime holding up a dollar." That meant I'm the dollar. I need to get to work. And then we'd also say, can't see it from my house if somebody screwed something right up. All right. The stand-up special, Intolerant. I would tell you guys it's funny, but that, of course, all you have to do is say Jim Jefferies stand-up special, and you know it's funny. So it is a Jim Jefferies stand-up special. It's available on Netflix, and also you can check out the podcast. I Don't Know About That with Jim Jefferies, which I'll be featured on soon, talking about dados, dovetail joints, finger joints, and rabbit joints as well. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. We'll see you soon. Let me tell you guys about LifeLock. There's a new phishing scam that masquerades as a billing error, and you'll get the alert from Netflix, although it's not from Netflix, and they're pushing victims to update their payment details within 24 hours of their subscription, or their subscription, I should say, will be voided, and nobody wants that because we want to see the Jim Jefferies specials. The link even directs to a very real-looking CAPTCHA form. So it's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives every day. We put our info out on the internet. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If you become a victim of identity theft, you have access to dedicated restoration specialist at LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
All right. Tempe, Arizona Improv, September 18th and 19th. Live podcast and stand-up show there. Rob Schneider's going to be up on stage on the 19th. Salt Lake City Wise Guys coming up October 2nd and 3rd. We'll do a live...
Also, I'm hearing Mark Garagus is going to do a live Reasonable Doubt in Salt Lake City as well.
Oh, that's coming up too, yeah. And you can also check out the live podcast there as well. And my book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, it's available now on Amazon. Write a review. I shall read it and all the good stuff. And until next time, it's Adam Carolla, Gina Gradin, Paul Bryan, and Jim Jefferies. Good sports coming up next, saying mahalo.
Dave Damashek and Adam Carolla return for Good Sports right after this.
Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. You made it through another week of sports action here. And to break it all down, Adam Carolla up there, Dave Damashek here. Good sports. Welcome to it. Happy Friday, Ace. We left off yesterday. We were talking a little bit about the two inhabitants of the brand new SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles. The Chargers, it's hard to argue with what they did with their uniforms now that we see them. So I try to reserve judgment until at least we can see them out on the field. And final judgment can't be issued until we see them against another team. But the Chargers look just sublime with that powder blue and the numbers on the white hats and everything. The Rams, I don't know what to make of it yet. How say you?
I was watching Hard Knocks and I was looking. Oh, we got a little static. Can you hear me? I was looking at Hard Knocks and I was focusing on the numbers and the weird fade with the number and it fading from yellow to sort of gray or white at the bottom of the number. And it felt distracting and weird to me.
It's supposed to be the Southern California sunset, I believe. I think that's what it's supposed to honor, that gradient, I think they call it when they do that. I don't love those. I think that they I'll make a prediction now. You can only change your uniforms in the NFL every 5 years. So once you issue your formal uniform, no matter if it's if everybody in the world hates it, you still can't change it for another 5 years. I hereby predict that the Rams will change these uniforms in 5 years. There's no way that sometimes I'll be like, all right, you know what? Now that I've seen them, they've grown on me a little bit. I'm okay with them. I predict that these are not. I don't hate them. It's just unnecessary, that weird gradient. The ones that suck, though, straight up, are the beige road ones, and they're called bone. They're called bone. Like, that's going to be their road getup, and those are –
I've not even seen those. There's first off, a couple of things that you talk about. Like, this is supposed to represent the sunset. When you have to start explaining, you're basically the fat chick with the Chinese characters on your forearm. This is pride. This means pride. This others is an homage. Right? Like, okay, all I'm seeing is a fat chick at the bar. The explanation is not helping. Is it white or is it beige or is it bone?
That's why I say I reserve judgment on these things until I can see them. They were in SoFi Stadium. I guess they did they show up on Hard Knocks or not? But I know I've seen in the last week some video of them out in SoFi Stadium walking around. And once I saw Jared Goff walking around, I was like, yep, I was right. Those are bad. They just look like, I mean, there'll be a million jokes about it, but they really do just look like they got put in the wash with some black clothes and it just changed the white into like this off-white kind of mess. It just doesn't look right, and there's no way they're going to grow on me. There's no way I'm going to reverse my opinion on them. We'll have to wait and see. But you have to wait and see what they look like. Let me ask you something else. On Extra Points that I'm doing with our pal Sal, he asked me something interesting because my Pirates got no hit last week by a guy named Lucas Giolito. And he said it didn't even make news. Well, like it wasn't national news.
I've never heard of it.
Yep. Did you hear that he got a White Sox pitcher threw a no hitter?
No.
That would have been impossible when we were kids, right? I think that's an interesting point by Sal, isn't it? That no hitters somehow have fallen off the radar for us. Why is that?
Well, in today's racially charged climate, I got to believe if they were playing the Black Sox, it definitely would have made CNN for sure. I don't know about Fox, but that kind of achievement would have done it. Maybe it's the white that had, again, I don't want to racialize this, but maybe it had something to do with the word white leading the way. I don't know. There's now officially too much and sort of too many of everything. You know what I mean? Like at a certain point, it's like winning the Oscar. Oh, look at him. John Wayne's got an Oscar. That was a big deal or whatever. Now, you could sit down and I could get a picture of, and now this would have been an impossibility with a 14-year-old Dave Damashek and a 14-year-old Adam Carolla. Imagine saying, you could do this with your kids. I'd do it. I got 14-year-old twins. You know, I'm going to get a headshot of the last decade of best man and best woman, best actor, best actress, best supporting actor. And I'll just show it to my kids. And you tell me if you can name this person. They wouldn't be able to name three of them out of the 20 that from the last decade, right? And there's no way when we were kids, if they were showing, you know, Harrison Ford or Chuck Heston or whomever, Sissy Spacek, it wouldn't really matter. You would know who that person was, right? So
yeah.
We're now officially convoluted. You know, we're just, it's official. It's official.
There's your 2015 Best Actor winner. Can either of you name that gentleman?
I have no idea. I'm looking at a white, young individual. Timothée Chalamet.
Nope.
But I have no idea.
You're pretty close, Ace. I mean, I hate to poop on the point by saying, I think his name is Eddie Redmayne.
Correct. From the theory of everything.
Ace's random guess was pretty close to his real name.
I could give my son all the Kraft snackable cheese packs in the world. He couldn't come up with one initial from the I think you just take the last decade. You know, Gary, this would be a fun little experiment, which is if you took the decade, you'd have to kind of pick, you know, when you were 14 or when you were 15 or whatever that was. For me, you know, 1980, I was 15, 16, I turned 16. I think I was 15 and 82. If you just took the winners of that, I think we could name them, and I don't think my son would have a shot at it today. I really don't.
Boy, I think you're exactly right, and it's not exactly – to me, I've always felt like, kind of to your point, you care much more about sports when you're 13, about the wins and losses, and they hurt you much more deeply on some level. And it's because you've only experienced legitimately – like three or four years of sports watching. So you've only watched your team. Like, I'm a Steelers fan growing up, and like, well, then they were in the playoffs that year, and then they won the Super Bowl the next year, and then they missed the playoffs the next year. It's like those experiences aren't singular, but they're pretty distinctive. Now that I've been through 30 of them or 35 of them, they aren't as special. They're not as significant. But that doesn't explain why today's generation doesn't know who these people are. But we do know the people from our generation.
Gary cranked this thing out lickety split, unless it existed somewhere. So you got Henry Fonda,
right?
Then you got Duvall.
And Tender Mercies. Oh, what a gem of a performance!
I don't know who the older gentleman with the mustache is, but then you got. No, I did a documentary on him. Obviously, you got Paul Newman next. You got what's his name from Gandhi? God damn it.
Ben Kingsley.
Then you got the guy from, I don't know, the one guy in the middle is a character actor, and I do not know his name.
F. Murray Abraham.
Is that F. Murray Abraham? I don't think that's him. It is?
That's F. Murray Abraham. Sure.
F. Murray Abraham's in that photo.
Oh,
for sure.
That's him then. Right. Then, of course, so you got De Niro. Then you got, is that My Left Foot? What's his name on there? Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yep.
Yeah.
Then you got, what's his name from the Streets of San Francisco?
I like that that's your reference for Michael Douglas.
Michael Douglas. And
if only he'd gone on to do any bigger roles than Streets of San Francisco with Malden.
Yeah, it's kind of one and done with Douglas over there. And then you got William Hurt. Is that William Hurt at the end?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So nice.
I think you missed Hoffman, but
is that Hoffman? No, Hoffman.
I'm looking at the list here. According to the list, in '88, Dustin Hoffman won for Rain Man.
Well, John Hurt is not. It's William Hurt there. Yeah.
He's not on the picture you're showing us, but. F. Murray Abraham's a guy I couldn't get. All right, so basically, back in when I was 15, I could get 9 out of 8 out of 10 or whatever it was. Is that how many is that, Gary? Is that 1, 2? Is that 10? 9 or 10?
For some reason, this picture is only showing 9. So you're correct in that Hoffman's not in this.
And that goes back. That goes forward from 1980.
That's the
80s. All right, so I could get all the people from when I was young, you know, or from the 80s or whatever it is. Sonny wouldn't have a chance at
that. I guess that's the thing. It's like that's what I said to Sal about it too. I mean, I remember when Pete Rose had his hit streak going, and he was well off of Joe DiMaggio's 56 games. But by the time he was in the late 30s, they would break in on network TV to be like, Pete Rose, third at bat, still doesn't have a hit tonight. Let's see if he can keep it going. And the nation was enraptured by this. What would be the equivalent of that? There would be no sports deed that would require them to break in on network television in prime time to show you a baseball player's at bat to see if he gets it. And by the way, it's not like he was at – it'd be one thing if a guy was about to break a record. He was 12 – he got to 44 when the streak ended, and they were breaking in to show it. It was that was really crazy. That's kind of stuff just doesn't seem like it happens anymore. I guess we have Sports Center and everything else.
There's no sport version of that anymore. And yeah, Sal is right. The idea that someone throws a no hitter and it doesn't land on anyone's radar. I'm a guy who keeps after sports pretty regularly. Never heard of it. All right.
Let me
hit Bet Online here. NBA, NHL, the playoffs. Oh, they're up and running. We got you covered over here at Bet Online. Get in on all the action, including a new NBA playoff bracket contest. MLB continues through the summer, too, as well. No shortage of ways to get in on the action. Bet Online has hundreds of odds, futures, and prop bets as well, not to mention UFC and boxing and all the combat sports as well. Head to their website today, sign up, receive your welcome bonus on your first deposit. So what you do is you go to betonline.ag. It's our exclusive partner at Podcast One. Don't forget, use the promo code Podcast One for your sign up bonus today. Let's get started. Let's make it interesting. Maybe there's a fight coming up and you don't particularly care who wins. Well, get in on the action and then you're going to care. Bet Online, your online sportsbook experts.
Ace, I couldn't be more pleased to tell you, we are within a mere days from NFL kickoff. Let's stay on track. I mean, we're getting close. And then, I mean, it's great fun for me to get to talk to Adam Carolla and into the microphones and stuff, but we're about to really start cooking with gas because football is just about here. Can't wait to do that. In the meantime, that's a wrap on another week of hot sports talk here on Good Sports. We'll talk to you next week. Until then, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damashek, Good Sports out.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Get Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. All the links are at adamcarolla.com.
And before we get out of here, one more thanks to Geico. Do you own? Do you rent? What do you do? Do you want a bundle? Well, you own or you rent. Or you got to have insurance. You got to have auto insurance. Bundle it. Make it easy. Save money. Let's get it under one roof at Geico. At geico.com, get a quote. See just how much you could be saving on your homeowners and your rental insurance when you bundle. That's Geico, geico.com.